Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of the Shift Network, and this Global Compassion Summit is co-produced with Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, as well as the Charter for Compassion. The Global Compassion Summit highlights the latest science and practices that help us embrace compassion and recognize compassionate action as an important path to peace. We're so grateful that you're here. Please share your questions or insights at www.facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, Emily Hine, the director of the Global Compassion Summit.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Emily Hine, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Global Compassion Summit, a production of the Shift Network. We're so grateful you're here with us today. It's deeply rewarding for me to introduce our next guest speaker, Alan Bosack. Alan Bosack is a South African theologian, speaker, and human rights activist. Actively engaged in the anti-apartheid struggle, he worked alongside Archbishop Desmond Tutu and President Nelson Mandela. He is the author of more than 20 books, the most recent being Radical Reconciliation, Beyond Political Pietism and Christian Quietism, and Dare We Speak of Hope, Searching for a Language of Life in Faith and Politics. Alan is the recipient of several awards, among others the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award and Martin Luther King Jr. Peace Award. He is currently the director of the Desmond Tutu Center for Peace, Reconciliation, and Global Justice, and holds the Desmond Tutu Chair for Peace, Justice, and Reconciliation Studies at Butler University and Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis. We are so very grateful you're here with us. Welcome, Alan Bosack.
Thank you, Emily. It is a privilege to be participating in this conversation today. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, in this session, we have a very, very rich topic. We're talking about the power of faith in struggles for justice. We're talking about why reconciliation is more than the settling of conflicts and accommodation of political realities, and why reconciliation with compassionate justice is crucial for the building of peaceful, compassionate, inclusive societies. So, Alan, you're really the expert on this, and so I'm going to just start out with a question that you and I have discussed already that will help us kick off this very deep topic. And the question is really about the role of religion. Religion has played such a devastating role in the enslavement and subjugation of people. How do you believe faith has become such an inspiration? How has faith become such an inspiration for struggles for justice, peace, and human dignity?
Thank you, Emily. It is a bit of a paradox, though, if one really thinks about it, that religion has been so effectively used in my own country and in the history of South Africa as part of the colonialist project. Christianity came along with that. Same is true for countries like the United States and other countries in the global South. And when one looks back and thinks about it, how effectively religion was used, and in our case, it was Christianity and the Bible, to try and inculcate into the slaves and the indigenous peoples and the subjugated peoples of these countries and of my own country an attitude of submission and meek acceptance and believing that suffering is not only just part of their lives, but suffering is part of God's will for their lives, and that slavery is part of God's will. Being subjected to phrases like, if you had not been brought here from your country as a slave, you would never have had the privilege of being introduced to Jesus Christ. And so growing up with that, and what did that do to the slaves? That's the one side of it. And so you had a Christianity that was ruthlessly abused and used for the subjugation of people and for the domination of them by others. And in our case, the white minority group in South Africa, who really believed themselves to be the best examples of Christianity that could ever be, and people who lived by the Bible and believed the words of the Bible. So when you look at South Africa's history and you see how, from the very beginning, when the people subjected to slavery and the indigenous people began to understand in their own way and interpret in their own way this gospel that they heard from missionary preachers, how they took from that gospel a message that was totally the opposite from what was intended. So somehow they found a message in the Bible that was not about subjugation, but about freedom. That was not about slavery, but about human dignity. That was not about injustice, but about justice. That was not about violent submission by others, but about genuine peace, which is a totally different kind of thing. And somehow that message filtered through and counteracted the messages that they heard. And it's quite amazing. There's a historian in the United States, Eugene Genovese, who, as somebody who is an atheist and did more of a materialist analysis of history of African slaves in the United States, and the author of the book Roll Jordan Roll, and he says he did that as a quite dispassionate study, but also a study of somebody who expected religion just to be what I described first, simply the kind of opiate of the people, keep them down, keep them submissive, subject them, and make them believe that what they're doing is they're also doing for God. And he says how absolutely amazed he was to discover, as a materialist historian, the power of religion in the lives, and the Christian religion, in the lives of the slaves in the United States, how it not only helped them to survive, but helped them to resist and to build up a reservoir of resistance against oppression that began in the slave times and that we can see through the civil rights movement. And the same is actually true of South Africa. So something in that message is resilient enough to survive the abuses by the colonizer. And we have found that by the time that in South Africa we began to formalize our resistance, and I mean by that not just a little revolt here and a slave revolt there and an uprising here or something there, but I mean organized political resistance through the forming of the African National Congress way back in 1912. How many of those first leaders of the African National Congress were Christians who had simply decided that their understanding of Christianity means that they should stand up and fight for freedom and for justice and for human dignity? And they found that message in the Bible and in South Africa. The remarkable thing is how that inspiration given by faith has been persistent throughout the years, and we see that in the first years of the ANC, we see that in the first massive resistance and civil disobedience campaigns in the 1950s, called the Defiance Campaign, where every day's activities had been begun by church services the night before, where the day's activities were ended by church services, where people got together and where they prayed together, and how much freedom songs, who were also hymns from the tradition, were used as inspiration. And that was true in 1960, and that became true again in 1976 with the new generation. And in the final phase of the struggle, that began in 1983, where the churches played such a unique and important role together with and under the leadership of the youth, I must say, how our religion and how people's faith, and here I'm just not talking about the Christian faith, I'm talking about the Muslims and the Jews and the Hindus and all of those people who found in their religion enough inspiration and strength and courage to stand up to a ruthless regime that was accused of having committed crimes against humanity, because that was what apartheid was. And so I have come to believe that people of faith need not say, because our religion had been once abused for the subjugation and to justify oppression and violence and war, that we must either write it off or there is nothing in it for us. I believe that there are enough examples in history for us to say, but that same religion offers so much more, and in the end nullifies the abuse of it by the way in which oppressed people can draw faith and courage from it. And I must say, Emily, this is not just a kind of a theoretical thing for me. I have seen with my own eyes in the many years that I have been in struggle and in the fight against the apartheid regime, with its violence and with its almost unspeakable brutality, how people, driven by their faith, would go on the streets day after day and face the dogs and the guns and the tear gas, and go to prison and be tortured and see their comrades killed and their family shot down and so forth, and yet come back again and again with prayer and song and the faith that the God in whom we believe is a God of justice and peace and compassion, and that this God will help us to gain the victory. And that is what we have seen and we have tasted. And so I have learned a lot from how faith can give people the kind of courage that we would normally not have. In my own life, I must say that I certainly would not have been able to get through almost 30 years of being part of the struggle and face some of the issues that I had faced if it were not for something beyond myself, and if it were not for something beyond political slogans and ideological truths to which one clings in times of difficulty and in times of struggle. There has to be something more, and we found that more in our faith. And had it not been for that, I don't think that we would have gone through it. And I'm talking a lot, but just let me say one more thing. It is also true that faith played an amazing role in the way in which South Africa's struggle was conducted, but also in the way in which that struggle was ended. People who will listen to us now and who know something about the South African history will perhaps recall that by the time that we got to the 1980s, the 1980s is now recognized as probably the darkest period of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. We haven't ever seen so much violence and so much suppression and so much blood as in that period. And towards the end, in the middle of the 1980s, when we had two successive states of emergency, in my discussions with politicians from abroad and journalists and observers and analysts, there was hardly anybody who would be able to say or wanted to say that the South African struggle still has an opportunity not to end in a civil war and total bloodshed. Everybody expected that there would be simply such a conflagration in the end that South Africans would simply just destroy each other until the last person. What is it then that avoided that fatal end? What is it that made South Africans think twice before giving themselves over to the lust for revenge and retribution towards the end of apartheid in 1988 and 1989. And part of that reason was the role that faith has always played in the life of people and in the life of the struggle. When Nelson Mandela, in 1998, when he received the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission from Archbishop Desmond Tutu, when Nelson Mandela made the statement that reconciliation has always been at the heart of the struggle of our people and the driving force of the struggle of our people, there were some people who thought that he was a bit cynical and this was just a bit of political expediency. But I don't think that that is true. I think Nelson Mandela looked at the history of South Africa. Nelson Mandela looked at what was it that was really the inspiration behind ordinary people's life of sacrifice and what they were doing all those 27 years he had been in prison. What is it that kept them going and kept them on the streets and kept them defying one of the most brutal regimes in the world at that time? And he found that It was indeed people's faith. And what is it that made people understand, even in the midst of the conflict, even in the midst of the oppression, and even in the midst of all the violence, what is it that made them understand we've got to deliberately create space for reconciliation? And I have come to believe that if you don't do that, then everything you do will be in vain. It will be so insecure. No revolution of values and transformation of society is complete and is more secure than under other circumstances if it does not have created space for reconciliation. And I believe because that would be the foundation upon which the new society must be built. And all I can say is all these things that kept South Africa open for the possibility of reconciliation and of a shared future, even with our worst enemies, that had not been more inspired by anything else but by people's faith.
Wow, such an extraordinary historical lesson that you just helped us all understand. The beautiful way that you phrase this, the paradox between how faith was both the kind of the initial creation of the suffering in the parts of the
yes.
people that this became the role, you know, how the people were subjugated, and then also faith became, you know, the tool for healing, the tool for stepping up and stepping into freedom and recognizing that every human being has a right to that freedom.
Yes.
And so in what you're saying here as well is, you know, with all of that history, the only way to move forward is really through this kind of radical reconciliation, bringing
yes.
the people together to recognize their common, what we talk about in our compassion education programs at Stanford is kind of common humanity, recognizing
yes.
each other's common humanity, that just like me, this person wants freedom. Can you speak a bit more about radical reconciliation and the role of compassion in bringing people together, truly together, for transformative healing?
Yes, let me say this. I use the term radical reconciliation because in our experience over the last 20 years in South Africa, where we have embarked upon a process of reconciliation, which is still not ended, of course, because it is a process, a long, deep-going process, if we do it right. How in South Africa, reconciliation had so easily become another tool for pacification for people instead of a tool an instrument for radical transformation of people's lives and of society. And so we talk far too easily, I think, and too glibly about reconciliation. And I've come to the conclusion that we must be far more careful and that we must say reconciliation is such a deep process. It is such a demanding process. It covers so much of everything in people's lives and in a country's life that we must be very clear. When we speak of reconciliation, we must know that you cannot speak of reconciliation if you are not willing to face the past honestly and with integrity, and not try to run away from it. Reconciliation is not possible without that kind of confrontation with the past and with the evil in the present, even if the past is evil. And that evil must be seen, must be recognized, must be taken responsibility for, so that we can understand what it is that actually had been done to people. Reconciliation is radical because it is not really possible without repentance and remorse and forgiveness, and you can imagine what that asks of people politically and personally and as communities. It is not possible without restitution, without restoring what has been taken away from people, and it is not possible without the restoration of people's human dignity. And all of that must be done with a deep sense of justice and a deep sense of compassion. So even if you hold people accountable, and even if you hold people responsible, it is not an accountability that comes from an understanding that justice means revenge and retribution. I have come to understand, and it pains me to see how in the United States, for instance, whenever people speak of justice, they almost always understand justice only as punishment, as retribution, as revenge for something. Whereas if we can understand justice as the restoration of dignity, as the restoration of someone's humanity, as the restoration both of the victim and of the perpetrator in a different way, that's when justice, compassionate justice, becomes a reality and can be made a reality not just in the personal relationships with people, but it can be made a reality in political realities and political relationships with people. And so for us, compassion is linked with this justice. It is linked with reconciliation. And if all of these are brought together, then from my view, reconciliation is radical, because then it goes down to the roots. I talk about radical reconciliation from the Latin word radix, which means it really does go down to the root of things. It's nothing superficial. It's not an airy-fairy process. It's not trying to just paper over the cracks. It is understanding how deep the cracks in society actually are. It's understanding the deep chasm between people in a nation. It's understanding the incredible hurt. It's understanding the damage, the injury that is being done to people through oppression and domination, and trying to address that in the most honest fashion that we can think of in just about every way. And so for us, that is part of my understanding for radical reconciliation. If you link that with compassion, the way you spoke about compassion is what we Africans call Ubuntu. And Ubuntu is, and everybody who knows Archbishop Desmond Tutu will know that that is just about at the heart of his life and of the heart of his understanding of his faith and of his understanding of life together in a community. So Ubuntu is an old African understanding, an African way of life, much more than just a concept or a broad philosophy. It is part of the way Africans live, of the way they see themselves in the world, in relating to other people, because Ubuntu says, I am only because you are. I cannot be what I am unless you are what you need to be. My humanity is totally caught up in your humanity. And if I do something, if I do you an injury, if I do you damage, if I hurt or insult you, I do not only take away something of your humanity, I diminish my own humanity. And so in order for us to live together as people who recognize within each other a humanity that cannot live without the other, we have to always ask, what is it that I can do that will help you maintain your humanity? Or what is it that I have done that took away from your humanity and also in the same process, therefore, diminished my own humanity? And so Ubuntu is that concept that seeks a wholeness in life, that knows that I cannot exist without the other. And if the other does not recognize in me something of themselves, in our striving to reflect something of what Christians call the image of God in us, in order to make human community possible and meaningful, that is what drives our compassion. So that I really say to myself, I cannot begin this day without realizing I'm not in the world on my own. And the things that I say and the things that I do have an impact on the way in which others can be what they must be. And we can only be that if we are that together, not taken out in little individualistic packages and put apart from one another, so that our contact with one another is only piecemeal and almost accidental, but that we know that all life is integrated in that kind of way, and that the network of mutuality, to quote Martin Luther King, that binds us together, that's what Africans call Ubuntu.
Wow, such a beautiful term. I've definitely heard it before, but not with this level of depth, Alan. Thank you for that. And it occurs to me as you're speaking, I and this might be a bit sophomoric, so forgive me if it is, but I think about this, the notion of restorative justice, which is starting to evolve more here in the United States, where the oppressors and the, you know, quote unquote victims are come together to really, as you said, take responsibility for the actions that they took that created suffering on the others. And yes, as I was listening to you speak and thinking about apartheid and the depth of suffering that occurred with so many people for so long and that continues to occur in various ways around the world, do you think that the oppressors might be unwilling to take that responsibility because they are unwilling to look at their own depth of suffering, excuse me, related to how they've treated other human beings, that the level of suffering one has to face in looking at kind of the worst side of humanity might prevent them from stepping up to the table in a restorative justice model because they don't want to face their own suffering of what they've done.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's very difficult for oppressors to do that. And that is one of the reasons why we have always said, in South Africa, our freedom is really inextricably bound with the freedom of white people. And they must understand they will never be free unless we are free. And so they have to deal with what is it that we are doing with people. Apartheid was a horrific experience, and almost if you see apartheid in the historical development from colonialism to dispossession to slavery to genocide to apartheid, it's all in one single history in our country. And when we looked back to over 350 years of this kind of history and conflict and bloodshed and dehumanization, and we began to understand truly what it meant when we called apartheid a crime against humanity, to then go to the oppressor and say, this is what you have to face, and this is what you have to take responsibility for, this is what we will hold you accountable for. That's a frightening aspect of such a situation. It's a little bit persnickety, but when way back in 1977, I spoke at a very well-known white university, and one of the students asked the question, "What will you do if you take power in this country?" Now this is 1977, 1978, and I thought, I cannot answer this young man seriously, so I'll just make a little bit of a joke about it. And so I said, you know what? I won't change anything at all. you guys have written all these laws for the benefit of white people. I'll just scratch out white and I'll write black where you have written white. And I'll make all those laws and all those privileges and all that power, I'll make applicable to us. And I thought I was sort of lightening the moment, because it was a very heavy evening with political discussion. And some of the students were smiling, but he jumped up and shouted. He said, "That's exactly what I thought. I knew you would say that." So the fear of oppressors, that there is really no other alternative than that their oppression and their violence will be turned against themselves. That is the greatest fear that they have, that they will do to us what we have done to them. And what we have tried to do in South Africa, and we've not succeeded, and there's lots of difficulties, and I think we have failed in many ways, but what we have tried to do in South Africa is to say to white people, this is a crime against humanity, and in reality all you guys are criminals against humanity. So it is as serious as that, and one must not try to diminish or trivialize that. But we said, instead of treating you like criminals, we will treat you with compassion. We will offer you political forgiveness. We will not treat you as criminals. We will treat you as political adversaries. That is what our decision meant, not to continue with the conflict, but to choose for negotiations and to sit around the table and to draw white people into the discussion, not just about the past, but how do we build a common shared future together. That's an amazing thing, and I think that people, white people in South Africa, but perhaps people across the world, still do not understand the extraordinary magnanimity of black people in South Africa, that we said we will not use justice. I mean, some people said we are using restorative justice, and I understand the way that you speak of restorative justice, but even that, restorative justice says, actually, it remains within the criminal justice system. You take responsibility, you are sent to court, you go to prison, and while you are in prison, we work out a way in which you can restore the relationship with the community in which you live, and especially the relationship with the victim. What we said to South Africans is we will not hold you criminally responsible. So we do not aim to send everybody to prison. We are not going to go the road that that was followed, which is our only precedent in history, of the Nuremberg trials. We will forego all of that. And what we will offer instead of retributive justice is we will offer what South Africans call survivor's justice. We will say apartheid was a horrendous crime against humanity. It was a calamity which we survived as black people today here. But you, as white people, also survived it. So we will not claim victor's justice, and we will not claim victim's justice. We will say we will share the justice of survivors. And so I will not do anything to you that will jeopardize your further survival and growing with me and building with me in this new society. That is an extraordinary thing. First time in history, nobody has ever done that. And that white people today in South Africa do not understand and does not reciprocate with social and economic justice. That is one of the great difficulties and failures of our reconciliation process. And so trying to make people understand a different form of justice, a different form of accountability, so that you are held accountable, but it is possible that you can be forgiven. If you ask for forgiveness, it's of course the most wonderful and ideal thing. But many of the people who had been pointed out as criminally, physically involved in the torturing and so forth of our people have not even asked for forgiveness. And yet, the forgiveness has been offered. Now, that creates such a different paradigm that it is hard for people. White people, I think, can still not overcome their fear that this is too good to be true. At some point, they think, at some point down the line, they will take their revenge on us. That is why you have all those stories, scary stories about, ooh, when Mandela dies, white people are going to be killed by the hundreds. They're going to be chased into the sea. And that, again, has proved not to be true or realistic at all, because that's not what we have in mind. I would almost think, in today's world of violence, it'll be so much easier for black people simply to say, the best way for us is to take revenge, kill a few white people, and show them this is how we feel about things. But we took the more difficult road. What does it mean when you take justice and you fill it with compassion? What does it mean when you take justice and you walk away from your natural inclination to revenge? What does it mean when you offer people the restoration of their human dignity, because you believe even though you hurt me, you hurt yourself as well? And so that we together must now try and find our common humanity in a new paradigm. That's the harder road to take. But from my point of view, Emily, I can say it is the much more difficult road, for some people even the impossible road. And some cynical people say, well, we'll never be able to do it. But I think it is always worthwhile. It is the only worthwhile road to take, to walk away from the conflict, to walk away from the violence, to walk away from the natural inclination to avenge yourself, to walk away from retribution, and to ask the question, how can we live compassionately with one another, and how can we make a compassion and Ubuntu a foundation of a new society beyond the violence and beyond the oppression and beyond the inhumanity and beyond the racism?
Wow. I find myself literally wanting to bow down to this concept of survivor's justice, because it is so filled with heart, and it is so filled with strength and courage, and the reality that in offering survivor's justice the way that you describe it, you are esteeming humanity at the highest level.
Yes.
You are saying, we believe in your ability to join us at the table,
yes,
to be a part of the solution. We would rather have you there with us, reconciling together, you know, radically reconciling together, than locked away in prison, paying for what you've done in that way. We believe in your humanity and your potential that much. That's what that says to me. That's what that feels like to me as you describe it.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, that is the way. I mean, if you say that what we are struggling for while we struggle has to be the opposite of the society in which we find ourselves in, and if one of apartheid's hallmarks, one of its pillars that it couldn't live without, was its exclusivity, excluding black people because they are not worthy, excluding blacks from privilege because they are less than human, excluding black from life because their lives don't matter, excluding them from just about everything that makes human life meaningful. If that was the heart of the old apartheid system, then the heart of the new society that we are trying to build has to be a radical inclusivity of all our people at every level, not just black and white, but those with physical disabilities. That's why in our constitution you have, and we have a wonderful, one of the most progressive constitutions in the world today, there is so much emphasis on the inclusive nature of South African society. All religions and people who do not have any form of faith but believe in other ways of being human, that has to be included. Women have to be included. Children have rights, and all those rights have to be included and have to be respected and have to be promoted and protected. And so every single area of life has all of them. So with us from the very beginning, LGBTI people, there was not a question of their humanity and of their dignity and of their rights, and how they should share the rights of every other single South African. And without their exclusion, we would not be normal. We would make of ourselves an abnormality, an absurdity. If you say our constitution is built on the principle of Ubuntu, that means the whole legal system has to be rethought and revised. The whole way in which law enforcement work has to be thought through again. The way in which business is being done. All of these things ought to be permeated by an attempt to understand all of this anew. And the inclusivity began when we said to white people, we will not push you aside because of your past and what you did to us, but we will, as you say, invite you, include you in the most intimate discussions of how our society, our new society, has to be built. And it's not going to be a society for black people only. It's going to be a home for all, as our leader Albert Luthuli said way back in the 1950s. What we want is for South Africa to be an ascendancy of our unity and a home for all, in which every single person in this country can feel rooted and feel that they are indeed at home. So that feeling of belonging is part of a way in which we say, how can we express this, not just in personal relationships or in communal relationships or in community relationships, but in our legal structures and our political ways and things. And maybe, again, I must say, some people say you're setting the bar too high. But my feeling is, and my conviction is, if we say to ourselves, we must be satisfied with the minimal of any of this. So if we say to us, to South Africans, oh, you know what, we've done wonders, it's wonderful, don't worry about it anymore, because we have stopped killing, we're not killing each other. But the question must always be for people with a compassionate heart, and for people who think about the future, and the people who think about what living together in a real democracy really means. It's not how can we stop the killing, but how can we devise ways of living together, and not just living together, but living together in a way that would let everyone bloom to their full potential, enhance their meaning of life, not as an individual that rises far above the others, but as a person amongst others without whom we do not want to take the step further, because that might break the solidarity that we have. And so, yeah, those are the things that I think we must still try and find ways of translating into all sorts of realities in South Africa, but I think it's possible. And I certainly think it is a contribution that one can make to the world.
There is no doubt. And I want to say that I don't think that bar is too high. I think that if we don't, as human beings, collectively hold that kind of vision for ourselves, then we'll never get there.
Yes.
So
yes.
I appreciate the bar, and I appreciate so much everything that you and all of your predecessors have brought to our collective human evolution. It is nothing short of compassion in action in our world in an extraordinary way. That's not really been seen before. So I honor you. I really appreciate that you've dedicated your life to helping reconcile in such radical ways, and that you are bringing this message of compassion to the world in such an extraordinary way. Switching gears a bit, Alan, you are part of the Global Advisory Council for the Charter for Compassion. Would you please speak a bit about the importance of the Charter in South Africa, particularly as the country continues its efforts in forgiveness and reconciliation?
Yes, Emily, the thing about the Charter and why I am so privileged and excited to be part of that, it is a global Charter for Compassion. And so we have realized from the very beginning that this is not something that one can do in one little corner and then in another little corner and then in another little corner, almost piece by piece. We saw from the very beginning how the issues that are facing us are not facing us just as individuals or groups of people or communities or even as nations. It's facing humanity, and there's no denial about that anymore. The crisis in our environmental situation in terms of ecological justice, what happens to our planet, the questions of war and peace, the questions of violence and nonviolence, the questions of how religion can either bring people together in compassionate action or divide people fiercely and be a driving force behind the worst kind of violence one can imagine, the question of economic justice issues, all those things are now global issues. And so I'm very, very excited to see how the Charter challenges this as global matters. That's the first thing. The second thing about the Charter that makes me excited is that it is working with an understanding of compassion that is comprehensive. So first of all, we certainly do realize that compassion has to do with a personal understanding. It's a spiritual thing. It has to come from within the heart of an individual, but we also see how that can be something that can spread out to a whole community, and you can create not just portions of compassion, you can create pockets of compassion, you can create areas of compassion, you can create people in groups who can think about that. And so compassion for me as a kind of essential presence in everything that we do. And if I think of South Africa, I think now in our reconciliation processes, which are sometimes going all right, sometimes going not so well at all, we continue to identify those things that we see as the problems that keep on facing us, the stumbling blocks toward the kind of reconciled society that we would like. And of course, the race has to do with it. Apartheid continues to cast its long, dark shadow over everything we do. There is the divisions between not just black and white, but between rich and poor, which is now larger and more threatening than it has ever been before, even in the days of apartheid. But there's also one other constant thing, and this is that people in South Africa continue to say politics is what is driving us apart. And I don't think it means party politics, that the one party is particularly vicious towards the other political party. I think people talk about politics as a whole, the way our politics is understood, the way our politics is driven. Can we have a political discourse in the country that has compassion at its center, so that even though somebody disagrees with me politically, that person does not become an enemy, but that person becomes a different voice into the conversation? And if that voice is totally off the mark of what we had set ourselves as an ideal for a society, your first reaction is that how can we eliminate this voice, because that's where all of the violence starts before you know it. But the first question would be, how can I engage this voice so that we can begin to see together that what we strive for has to be good for everyone? It has to be for the common good. It has to be for a shared future. It has to be something that the coming generations can embrace and can build upon and can make the foundation of yet another generation's work. And that ingredient is compassion. It's not just democracy and the cold analysis of how democracy works, but democracy will work if it is driven by the understanding of the kind of compassion that is not compartmentalized, but the compassion that the Charter has in view. In other words, a compassion that is linked to justice, to peace, to efforts to build a better society, to make this world a safe place for the most vulnerable, and to make this world a welcoming place for our children. And that is how I see the compassion work that the Charter is doing, how that comes into play and how that can make an enormous contribution
to the way in which our societies begin to look at themselves and how we can continue to find ways to build a yet better and better way of being human together.
Thank you so much. Given the extraordinary historical world events that you have witnessed personally, could you bring it down to a personal level for people who are listening to the call today and, you know, trying to find ways to take steps in their own lives, to take compassionate action in their respective communities, whether it's their school community, their faith-based community, their political community? Do you have any last words of wisdom for people who are kind of on the ground in ordinary ways, trying to live a compassionate life and contribute to this extraordinary high bar and vision that you see?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think our point of departure is that without compassion and without compassionate justice, our world is doomed to destruction. And I think more and more people are realizing that. And so we realize that we have to make that kind of contribution to our communities in which we live and to our societies in a broader way. And we have to translate all of these convictions into political and social and economic realities. Otherwise, this world will remain doomed. And so that begins with a famous thing, the piece that begins with me. Compassion begins with me. If I teach children to look at each other as the person without whose humanity I cannot exist, and I find ways to let children understand that, you build compassion, you build respect, you build a commonality, you build a mutuality in different ways. And so if I can find ways of teaching at the children at home and in school or in the religious institutions to which we belong, that would be a beginning. But also to always say to ourselves what we have been talking about, this is not just an unreachable ideal. If I think the example that, for instance, Nelson Mandela has set for the world, to be taken and told you are a traitor to your country, you are a terrorist, and all sorts of names, and they wanted to kill him, but decided that life imprisonment on Robben Island, where he was subjected to I don't know how many sorts of humiliations every single day. He couldn't touch the wife of his hand for the first 20 years that she was allowed to visit him. And so there was no human contact with the ones he loved most. And how his eyes began to gave in because he had to sit down and work with that limestone on the island and the dust from the stone. Went into his eyes, how his knees gave in. And by the time he got out of prison, his youth was taken away. His strength was taken away. He could have said, you've taken my life away. All that I have left is to use the power of my freedom and the power that my people give me and the power that history gives me to take my revenge upon those who have done this to me. And yet, Mandela found the strength, rooted in what we have talked about in the beginning, in the faith of his people, and in the way they have conducted the struggle. But for himself, it's one thing to say the struggle was this. It's quite another thing to say to yourself, I've been in prison for 27 years. Look what they have done to my life. How can I just make them feel a little bit of the pain? And yet when he stepped out of prison, the first words he uttered almost were the words of forgiveness and reconciliation. And that set an amazing example to our nation and ultimately to the world. Is it possible to say, I forgive in a personal manner? Yes. Is it possible with the moral courage and stature that that gives you, plus your life of sacrifice, so that your people will follow you and you don't use their loyalty and their willingness to follow you to destructive ends, but to compassionate ends that serve justice? And you say to our people, your job now is not to think, how will we avenge Mandela's 27 years in prison, but how can we make the last years of his life meaningful in the way that he wants us to? And he wants us to begin with thinking about justice and forgiveness and compassion. And they follow him on that. And to me, that is so wonderful. That is his inspiration to those of us who had the privilege of seeing him and hearing him and talking with him and touching him in the last years of his life while he was our president and while he was in the retired afterwards. So, and people must not say Mandela was too extraordinary a human being. He wasn't. He was an ordinary man. He slept in our house. I saw him. I saw when he got angry and what he got angry, and I heard him on the telephone. All of that. It is how he transcends these things for the sake of something bigger. And he says it's not just about Nelson Mandela, it's about the people of South Africa. And in doing that, he became this inspiration for the people of the world. And that's what I would like people to think about. What you do is and you do it with a view to build compassion and justice and common humanity and bring a little bit of Ubuntu. I call it the Ubuntuification of my life. And if you do that, you will find that you're doing it for yourself and your children, your community, but before you know it, you'll be doing it for your society, you'll be doing it for the country. You are setting an inextinguishable example for everybody. Mwangari Maathai of Kenya, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for her wonderful, wonderful work of justice in Kenya, had said all of these things that we do is like planting a seed of a tree in the ground, and before you know it, that tree has grown, and we form, and its leaves will form a canopy of hope, a shade under which all coming generations will sit down, and it will bear the fruit that will feed the children of those who are now hungry. That's amazing stuff. And that's how you have to think of the little things that you do every single day and what that will mean for people 2 years, 10 years, 50 years down the line. And you may not see it, but you will live with that wonderful thing in your heart. This is the little seed that I have planted. My tree is growing, and under the shade of that tree is one child who does not need to die of hunger or of violence or of injustice, because I have helped to make it so.
Alan, so beautiful. I think that this is a perfect, most inspirational place for us to end our time together today. And I just want to say, you know, personally and professionally, it's been an extraordinary privilege spending this time with you, and I want to thank you for taking such complex issues and distilling them down to concepts that really demonstrate, you know, especially through the people and the lives of South Africa, our human capacity for forgiveness and reconciliation and compassion. This is a lifelong lesson that will not be forgotten. Thank you so much for your time.
Emily. Thank you, Emily. It was a great privilege to be talking to you today. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. And for everybody listening, thank you for being with us for this very enlightening and hopeful talk with Alan Bosak. Please be sure to join us for the next session of the Global Compassion Summit. We'll be with you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit summerofpeace.net. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.